Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hello.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Howdy.
Howdy. Usually we have a discussion topic leading into a primary review. Today we are forgoing a discussion topic because, I don't know, not a lot of stuff happened. That's a lie. A lot of stuff happened, but it all happened a while ago. We were gone for a week, and, you know, it's just not happening. I will, however, say that you should comment and rate on iTunes if you like the show. Email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And listen up later in this episode to find out how you could win a copy on Blu-ray of Snowpiercer.
Ooh, listen up, listeners.
Listen up, listeners. Snowpiercer is coming. Don't be a shoe. Buy Snowpiercer. Actually, no, fuck that. Win Snowpiercer. Anyway, so that's pretty much it. Like I said, there's no lead in at all. Still somehow feels like this usually takes longer to get to the primary review. This week, our primary review is not, I say again, of the film Fury by director David Ayer, who had previously done End of Watch, the film
and
which took number one at the box office this weekend. It is not Fury, the film that currently has a 79% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and which The New Yorker's David Denby called one of the great war movies, right near the top, within range of Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan and other classics. Instead, we will be reviewing the follow-up to the cinematic thing called The Color Wheel by writer-director Alex Ross Perry.
This is getting off to a really awkward start.
Which stars, as it must, Jason Schwartzman, Elizabeth Moss, and Jonathan Pryce.
By the way, have you guys ever read the thing about David Denby's porn addiction?
I don't think I have.
Oh.
Is that true?
Yeah, no. In like 2003, he published this memoir, and there's a section about him talking about his addiction to porn, and Gawker posted it. And if you're interested in such a thing, you should read it because it's really magnificent.
Sounds interesting.
That is
it's really incredible.
As a person who's currently working on a nonfiction work about people in the sex trade, that actually is interesting to me.
Instead of going out, I entered in that summer of 1999 a dark and empty tunnel, an enclosure illuminated along the walls by a flash of naked men and women. I discovered porn on the internet. That's just a taste.
And what a taste it is.
Yeah. Anyway.
I would rather that we continue to listen to you read that entire piece, but we do have a movie to talk about. As we already said, Listen Up, Philip by director Alex Ross Perry. Here's the trailer.
Is that the new book?
Yeah. Things are going to be pretty crazy for me after the release. Los Angeles in January, San Francisco, and the whole West Coast thing, really. I'm told to expect big things out there.
You sound like you're bragging.
That's because I am bragging.
I can probably find you a lighter weight jacket.
Let's just keep this jacket on me and take the photograph sooner rather than later. I can't breathe here, and you seem to resent my presence.
Well, you're a cruel, miserable person.
I loved your book. Of course, I had achieved considerably more than you by now.
You'll need a country retreat. Stay with me.
Rub two sticks together. Make a fire.
All right, so Listen Up, Philip is out in limited release, probably. Right? It's got to be out, right?
Yeah, it opens at the IFC Center and Lincoln Center. And it expands, as independent films do. It's going to expand in the coming weeks.
Okay. Excellent. So, let's start it off. Danny King, what did you think of Listen Up, Philip? Actually, I should probably say what this movie's about.
Oh, yeah.
So, Philip, played by Jason Schwartzman, is a writer who's just about to publish his second book. and takes to systematically alienating everyone around him through being an incorrigible asshole. And Elizabeth Moss is his long-suffering girlfriend, and Jonathan Pryce is his idol, who becomes his mentor, Danny King. Thoughts on Listen Up, Philip?
Yeah. So we did, I don't remember how long ago was now, but we did talk about The Color Wheel on this podcast, which was the subject of much internal conflict. I recall Nick and myself enjoying the film, but Brian, not so much. That's correct, right?
I believe that is correct, yes.
So just one...
You mean that movie where it's black and white and two shitty people do shitty things?
Yeah. Well, okay. I'll start with an anecdote that will maybe get Perry more on Brian's good side. So this movie, Listen Up, Philip, is playing at the New York Film Festival. And before that, Lincoln Center did a series on previous films by the directors in this year's festival. So I went and saw The Color Wheel. And then afterwards, there was a Q&A with Perry. And the film seemed to like go over pretty well. And then he steps up and he starts talking. He's like, you know what, I just kind of want to start off by saying something. He's like, if you told me when I was making this movie 4 years ago that it would eventually be screening on 35 millimeter in the Walter Reed Theater, I would have done a much better job. And everyone just kind of like looked at each other like, what do you mean? Like, we kind of liked the movie. And he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, I don't want to brag, but I think Listen Up, Philip, we hit that one pretty dead on. But I'd say this movie, we were kind of operating at like a 4 or 5. And the conversation sort of proceeded from there. So one guy asked him like, well, what, can you just name like 3 things you didn't like about The Color Wheel? And Perry was kind of like, well, I just have to name 3. Like, can I keep going? So I thought that was a really funny anecdote. But like I said, he was much more confident in Listen Up, Philip, partly I think because he doesn't necessarily like acting or directing himself acting. So this movie, the new movie, I would say, does feel a lot more refined from a directorial standpoint. And just to get the overall reaction out of the way, I did really like the film. See where to start.
Well, for instance, what did you like about it?
Yeah, let's see. What did I like about it? So one thing I liked about it is that it sets itself up with this big gamble where we're following Philip for about 30 or 40 minutes. And each scene, or seemingly each scene, is him sort of making himself out to be a jerk in some kind of social situation. And the movie's really funny and fast-paced, and it's edited very quickly. But eventually this feeling sort of sets in, like, well, are we just going to be following this guy and enjoying his sort of narcissism? Like, what's kind of going to come of that? Is that really enough? And eventually the movie kind of makes a transition where we leave Philip and we follow his girlfriend, who's played by Elizabeth Moss. And that section of the film, which is maybe like 15 minutes, is where a lot of things clicked for me. There's a few flashbacks that are kind of hidden in there that I almost didn't even realize were flashbacks when I first watched them. There's a really amazing close-up on Moss after Philip leaves the apartment. And so what I think this section of the film does is it sort of twists the material, so we're no longer watching it out of kind of getting a... entertainment factor out of seeing these people be jerks, but we're understanding the damage that they create, and we sort of see them for how pathetic they are. And from there, the movie really kind of descends even darker, because it eventually focuses more on the character Ike Zimmerman, who's played by Jonathan Pryce, and he's just as much of a narcissist as Philip. And there's sort of this utterly disastrous sequence in the film where Price and one of his older writer friends try to kind of, they bring these two younger women into their house and they try to, you know, get with them, and they try to call Philip to make things better. And it's just sort of this like tornado of awful behavior. And it's almost 10 minutes that I found nearly unwatchable because of how just terrible these people were. But like I said, I think with this film, Perry has enough of a mature perspective that he's not, we're not just watching these people to be entertained by their awful behavior, but we are seeing the impact of it. Even if Philip doesn't necessarily understand it by the end of the movie, it's sort of like a somewhat of a stagnant character arc. And in that, it's sort of tragic because he never really understands himself, even though we do. So I guess that's just a long way of saying that I think this movie is a really, it's really rich in terms of its characters. And there's a lot of other things I could go on about, but I'll just stop there for now.
Nick Newman, what about yourself?
So yeah, you know, I think The Color Wheel remains something of a scar on this podcast in a way, just in the sense of I can think of very few films that we were so divided over, really.
Yeah, like what else was there? I was trying to think about that.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
It was To the Wonder for a while, but then y'all turned around.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, I guess so. So
doesn't really count anymore.
No, not really. But so, yeah, I was curious how our review for this would go, especially since I happen to really, really like this film. Maybe love? I'm not sure. I've seen it twice now. And both times I found the experience overwhelming in a way that I think Danny is alluding to here, or speaking to very eloquently, which is sort of this idea of it's not just that you're following one bad person, but that you're following multiple bad people and multiple selfish people and people who are quote-unquote unlikable. But I'm really not so fond of that as a descriptor, because I think that one of the greatest parts of this film is how people like the main character Philip Lewis Friedman are, yes, they're narcissistic and they're angry and they're mean to people, but they are also very hurt. And this is a very incisive portrayal of personal grief and personal pain, one that kind of can't be, one that you kind of can't get at in the filmic form. And so it makes sense that this probing study would have very quote-unquote literary qualities. And I interviewed Alex Ross Perry as well as Jason Schwartzman for the site, and you can find those interviews. And in my interview with Perry, you know, we talked about the movie's sort of literary aspects and its influences. And this has a voiceover from someone named Eric Bogosian.
Yeah.
Who
I was about to say, a voiceover not from J.K. Simmons. It sounded
what
like
J.K.
Simmons. I thought it was J.K. Simmons for like the entire movie until we started this podcast. And I was like, Eric Bogosian?
Yeah. Bogosian, who I have to confess I'm actually not really familiar with, nevertheless gives this movie a very sort of authorial tone, I think, in how it's observing Philip and how it is not just commenting upon what's happening, but sometimes providing a more authoritative voice. There's one particularly pivotal scene involving Schwartzman and Moss that features dialogue and features these sort of layered performances, but they're sort of stacked on top of them is this almost like voice of God in a way, explaining what is happening. I thought it was interesting how I read an interview with Perry where he talked about how there's a use of the word pitiful to refer to Philip's life at one point. And it's not a matter of opinion. It's just saying that it is objectively pitiful. And it's interesting to see a movie like this that is willing to be uncompromising in that way, but uncompromising while I think very naughty, very complex, very emotionally dense.
So naughty with a K.
Naughty with a K, as opposed to...
N-A-U-G-H-T-Y.
Oh, yeah. No, this isn't really a naughty movie. But
I was confused for a hot second there. Just wanted to be sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a pine tree.
Mm-hmm.
Like a naughty pine. Anyway, continue.
Right. So... Yes, believe it or not, I lost my train of thought amongst that. Thank you, Brian.
My secret plan is working.
But yeah, I mean, it's also a film that I appreciated for being sort of timeless in a way, because I feel like portrayals of New York have become a little stagnant in recent years, where a lot of it feels familiar in a certain sense. Everybody is on their iPhone. Everybody is using a computer. People are kind of relying upon these various new forms of communication to talk to one another. And it's interesting how all of that is gone. It is really just people either speaking with each other or just kind of sitting by themselves. There are a lot of moments in this movie where characters are just kind of staring and observing. And you get you can be told what they're thinking because of this Eric Bogosian narration or voiceover or whatever you want to call it. And yet at the same time, there is something else there. There's something in the face, because this movie is filled with close-ups. There's something in the face of the actor that you kind of can't get at, that you can't fully understand. There's kind of a mystery there. And I don't know, I found that just sort of compelling on a second-by-second basis. Even when, after two viewings, I remain a little ambivalent about some of its structural qualities. I guess there's sort of a bias because I'm a big Jason Schwartzman fan and I enjoy seeing him play a guy who is a total prick. And so, as much as I like Elizabeth Moss, I like Elizabeth Moss very much, during the other sections, I don't feel the pull of, I don't feel that attraction that I normally have. But I do think it is a well-balanced film, and I do appreciate the risks that Daniel alludes to, that it is willing to go off, that it is willing to play with different characters for a bit, and also be more reliant upon ramifications than in the moment actions. There's kind of an emotional honesty to that, and there's an emotional bravery, I think. Those are just some initial thoughts on The Snap Philip.
So I hated this movie, and I spent the last 2 hours wondering how I could articulate that intelligently. Because I was reminded of our podcast on The Hobbit, whatever the first Hobbit was
called. Oh my god.
And I was reminded of the only note that I've ever received from our illustrious editor-in-chief, Jordan Raup, which was, you cursed a little bit too much in this one, Brian. And so I'm being very careful to pick my words out from around the bile and vitriol and otherwise overly emotional four-letter words that I could use to describe the act of viewing this. And it's difficult. I hated this movie so much. I laid there watching it. My initial reaction, I'll just go beat by beat. My initial reaction was to hate the camera work. I don't know if it was just maybe I had a laggy internet connection because we were watching this on a press screener or what, but it was like shaky cam, like someone who'd seen Black Swan and then like took off one of their cameraman's shoes and said, I'd like you to do what they did in Black Swan, but minus one shoe so that you're an inch higher on one side so we get extra shake. I was willing to get over that because I was kind of on board for like the first scene of him bitching out one of the people from his past. Because I got it, you know, it was a moment, and his actions, I was like, okay, I get, you know, the way that this character is, I see this. And then it just kept going for nearly 2 hours. And it would do things seemingly arbitrarily, like those flashbacks during Elizabeth Moss's scene that come out of nowhere, exist for maybe 15 minutes, and then leave, and then never come back. I don't know. It's hard to even, like, I just kind of want to forget that I had to see this. I just kind of want to forget that I was made to watch another film by this man who clearly I don't understand, and I just don't even have the energy to try, because when I watch the things that he makes, I see a bunch of purposely pretentious, and that makes them more pretentious, moments and actions and words just being vomited in my direction with the vague hope that I'll be so overwhelmed by something, some feeling, that I'll just assume that because I'm feeling something so extreme, I'll like it. And I just don't, from the moment that full-on yellow, mustard yellow title popped up with the loops on the L and the P, I knew that I was in for trouble again. And
That's the classic Philip Roth font, actually.
That's fine. I know. I got it. Oh, I know. I know what it's alluding to. And like the very Wes Anderson-esque way that they would like show the books that people had written by like having them tiled on the screen. I was like, yeah, that's cool.
You had to have at least enjoyed the book covers. Like,
I like the names of the like, books.
Well, I don't know. I love how, you know, in the 80s, he wrote a book called Audit, and it so looked like an early to mid-80s book cover. It looks, looks like something my dad would own.
It reminded me of
that was nice.
Either a movie poster or an album cover. I don't know what it was. Like, yeah, I did like that. I actually watched a decent portion of the end credits because they were showing all of the books, and I found them amusing. So I guess it has that over the color wheel. But in general, oh boy, oh Father of Mercy, why did I have to watch this movie? I was angry with you, Nick. I placed this squarely on your shoulders. And I'm sure you might be fine with that, but I was legitimately like...
Can you hear my voice, the kind of expression that's on my face right now?
It's just like, I literally at one point said, hey, we could watch Fury, and you said something that's missing. And I was just like, okay, fine, I guess we won't watch Fury.
To be fair.
And so I watched this. I fucking watched it. I'm not like you. I don't just refuse to watch the movie. I fucking sat down. I took 2 hours out of a day, the first calm day that I've had in like 5 days, to watch a movie. I could have watched 6 episodes of Bob's Burgers and had a good time, but I watched Listen Up, Philip. And I did a damn good job of not cursing for maybe 10 minutes there and really trying to contextualize what is honestly a gut reaction to something that I find repellent. And that makes me question my place in the realm of film critics, because I know a lot of people I respect who liked this, and I just don't understand. And I don't think I ever will.
And this is,
it's another dark episode.
This is quite the...
Nick, you were going to say something?
I was going to say, to be fair, Fury is made by a man named David Ayer, who is terrible. Who's just like an awful filmmaker and an awful writer. Now, I have heard things about it recently that do make me curious, because apparently it is like 110 minutes of Nazis' heads exploding and brains being splattered on tents.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious.
Initially, though, I just thought I cannot go near that.
David Ayer, there was a tweet today that I think I retweeted or favorited or some nonsense like that, and it was something to the effect of, David Ayer has the career that Joe Carnahan deserves. Because, I think that Joe Carnahan is a better director. I enjoyed Stretch, even, and that was a very, very minor work. I think that Carnahan just has a better handle on tone and just basic filmmaking tenets. But I like the films I've seen by David Ayer because of the way that they interrogate concepts of like masculinity and like men versus men and put them into a popcorn movie that most of the times wouldn't even bother giving that much. I was genuinely moved by End of Watch because whatever he did and he got the actors to do worked for me. And it made me feel something that was actually tangible and meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like,
this movie made me feel quite a lot. It's kind of become a cliche among
all of the feels.
Not that specifically. It's become kind of a cliche among sort of people on Twitter who are talking about this movie to say, "Oh, really uncomfortable how much I identified with Listen Up, Philip." Nevertheless, really uncomfortable with how much I identified with Listen Up, Philip. A movie that I think gets at a lot of sort of unfortunate truths about the creative process and your relationships with people and how they not only grow from that, but kind of mutate, how they don't so much grow as they do metastasize like a tumor. And I mean, the movie kind of gets at these things in a very deep way with these very specific lines.
It feels so like cliched. Like,
Well, no, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there are very incisive remarks about, for instance, there's the thing about how, something along the lines of how he, you know, he felt uncomfortable when his girlfriend was happy about something, for instance, because there's a certain jealousy there that he doesn't even always realize, even though they're in different professions. There's this great line about, well, I'm glad he's dead, but that interview would have been really good for me.
But I mean, like, are those things that people would say? Like,
yes, they are. Unfortunately, I can assure you that these are things people would say. I know people like this, and honestly, it might seem hard to believe, but I really do know people who do have this sort of mentality, and I've had that sort of mentality a lot of times too, where, you know, sometimes like a bad thing happens to a person you hate, and you kind of go, oh, well, that doesn't really affect
me. But you
them,
don't fucking it. Say it out loud. I mean, it's just...
No, actually, not to get too personal about it, it depends the company you're in. And that's a scene that occurs among someone who we really trust, and not only really trust, but who this person kind of sees a lot of himself in Philip. And there is a thread that is formed throughout the film that kind of leads up to a line like that, where a thing like that can be said. And it can be said with some comfort.
Yeah, it
and
can be said
very...
with comfort because the guy is like a completely and utterly asinine cliche of a human being.
I'm not saying he's not a horrible person, but I'm saying that...
I don't even give a shit that he's a horrible person. I like horrible people in my movies. But like, it's just like, it's not... It doesn't feel real. It's just like the writer who happens to be the director, who happens to be my new best cinematic enemy... just sat down and was like, every time he can say a shitty thing, I'm going to have him say a shitty thing because he's a shitty guy, right? Yeah.
Well, okay. He says a lot of shitty things, but there are ways in which he does grow a bit and then he kind of falls back. This, again, goes back to something like the Eric Bogosian voiceover where it's remarked that, you know, he started to develop something of a warmness at the college in which he's teaching. And that felt very strange to him. And you see that in the performance itself. There's a very fine harmony established between material and the players of the material.
But he's only happy for like 10 minutes.
He is. And that's unfortunate because, you know, he's someone who doesn't really change.
So it doesn't even feel like he loses anything. Like, I forgot that was an arc he was supposed to have. I didn't pick up on that in performance or direction literally at all.
But it's literally stated out
loud. That's another fucking problem with the movie, Nick. You've got Eric Bogosian whispering in your ear everything you're supposed to feel. It's a bullshit, lazy shorthand.
I mean, I see it as more an integration with the images themselves, but... You might feel that way yourself. I mean, I think that, you know, for instance, at the end, there's a really fascinating push between voiceover and what you're actually seeing on the screen and what you're supposed to be hearing, what you would normally be hearing in a film, that I found really compelling.
You mean the one through the glass?
Yeah. Yeah, which I thought was... and, you know, and then there's that final sort of... that final statement on Philip as a character that I found sort of unshakably horrifying in a way that movies like this are not supposed to be unshakably horrifying, that a movie like this is willing to be, which I found very exciting.
A film that tread a lot of the same ground that I maybe didn't like that much, but I liked a hell of a lot more than this and that didn't need a voiceover? And another movie that made you extremely uncomfortable?
What?
Oh, I really want to see if you could guess it, though. It was... What? Danny, do you know?
No, I'm trying to think now.
Inside.
Oh, yeah, no, that's interesting. Still in the ring out.
Yeah, no, those are interesting comparisons to raise. But I also think that But Inside Llewyn Davis in its structure is more musical. It has a more musical feeling to it.
It has, like, actual control and, like, purpose and meaning. And
I think...
felt the craft behind Inside Llewyn Davis, even as I... was left a little cold by the story. And again, I feel like a lot of that was intentional. And in this, it was again, it was just like, I'll just make this guy say a bunch of shitty things. I'll follow these people around with the camera and I'll edit together and I'll put a little jazzy undertone to it and people will eat this shit up with a spoon.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think that comparison actually with Inside Llewyn Davis brings to light is that I sort of appreciated how little Perry seemed interested in having his characters actually write or give us any indication of what their process is like, because I think in a way that could have glorified them in a way. Like if we see, you know, Ike calling his daughter a bitch and all of these things, but we see him writing masterpieces, there would be something there that's not in the movie as it is. And I think in Inside Llewyn Davis, there is this kind of thing where, like, you know, maybe he acts like a jerk in certain situations, but I feel like within the first 2 minutes of that movie, you feel like he's a good guy just because of how he sings. Whereas this movie never really allows its characters that kind of a moment. And even Philip's novel is titled in such a way that you can't even attempt to predict what he writes about.
What was Join the Street Parade was his first.
Yeah, and then like Obadon.
Obadon.
And Ike's sort of the opposite. Like,
did
his
anyone
titles.
Do some light Googling and find out what Obadon means?
I should do that, actually.
I was about to say, none of us did that.
Yeah. maybe I did and nothing came up, so I just forgot about it.
That sounds like step one to me. You just have to get past the part where it's like, did you mean obedient? Are we all doing
apparently
this?
Apparently it's Hindi.
Oh.
Or,
he would. Obadon in Hindi. This is like asking, this doesn't help me at all, because what they're writing is in Hindi.
Mm-hmm.
The translation itself is in Hindi. What if I hit Hindi off? That doesn't help at all. Yeah, no, I don't know.
I want to go back to something you said that I find a little troubling, which is that you said that so it was sort of this stream of pretentious language, but isn't there a barrier between writer and character? Or I feel like that should be addressed a bit.
What do you mean between writer and character? Like the
well, you said that you felt there was this barrage of pretentious language.
Oh yeah, I believe that he means it to be that pretentious from the character's point of view.
Right.
Right.
So
I just think
he does it
poorly.
How so?
I just think it's like artless. It's like I said. It's like he didn't really put a lot of thought into it. There was a thing that kept happening. Maybe I was just delirious. But I could have sworn to God that every once in a while Jason Schwartzman would use the wrong word, or that the narrator would use the wrong word.
Mm-hmm.
Shit. I thought I wrote it down. I didn't. It was something like, it was the first time that Philip had felt satiated or sated or something in a while, but like, that was what they meant to say, but they said something else. And I was like, oh, isn't it interesting that you have all these people speaking in such high language, but they can make little not so obvious mistakes like that, which I guess is fine, but it's like, it's just an affectation that doesn't really do much to help me with the fact that it felt like an extremely pretentious person making up an even more extremely pretentious person. Or like, I just don't know. Like, there are films where people can act that way and you kind of get it and it makes sense and you like it, and this just wasn't one of them. It just didn't work for me, and it unfortunately, without me going through and watching it again and making notes, which I'll never do because fuck this movie, I unfortunately can't give much better than that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, and if it worked for you in that way, then that's great. And I'm not saying that Ross Perry believes that people talk this way or that they should talk this way. He's not Aaron Sorkin. I guess we can give him that. But I mean, like, it just didn't work for me. So, I mean, that's the thing where, yeah, he was trying and I can appreciate that, but it just didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which isn't his fault. I mean, it seems to work for other people.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a movie that just, even if I do find sort of the quote unquote second act of the movie, maybe a little, not bad. I mean, there's nothing about it that I actually quote unquote dislike. I just,
if you say quote unquote one more time, I
have
swear
I said
to
that
God, pillar? You literally just said it. Danny, am I wrong?
I actually didn't notice, but I think it probably happened.
I'm pretty sure you said, even though the quote unquote second act,
oh,
and then you said quote unquote again.
Oh, never mind. Well, not never mind. My point stands.
Right, but, you know.
Even if I don't find any of it...
quote-unquote.
Yeah. No, even if I don't find it quite as strong as the first and third, it is a movie that I kind of really appreciate the flow of, the sense of time that is kind of difficult to grasp because it seems to be jumping back and forth at least a little bit as far as perspectives are concerned. I thought it was a very nice balance, and I like how you can introduce a character such as Yvette Dussart, who's played by Josephine de la Baume. She can appear sort of almost out of nowhere, and there is something that feels like a natural transition there, how she can be integrated into the story. This character who we have not seen for something like an hour of a 110 minute movie.
It was an hour and 20 minutes in that we first met her.
Was it?
Yeah, I checked the time.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the thing. And then she becomes, I think, kind of a major figure in the final part of the film. And I don't know. There is kind of the sense of emotional destruction that right. is following it all.
But a lot of what happens, what comes out of that, is because of the voiceover.
I don't know. I found there to be great value in sort of the way these characters are bumping up against each other, the way that their emotional currents are kind of interacting.
Yeah. I love Terrence Malick films. I liked Stretch, as I said. I have no problem with voiceover as a rule in movies, but like it was so much in this fucking movie. It was like a Scorsese movie, but it wasn't as good, you know, obviously. The Wolf of Wall Street's like wall-to-wall narration sometimes, but that's like you're being told a very intriguing story by the guy on the screen as it's happening because you're in his world. Whereas this is like, we have a third-person omniscient who's just gonna fill in all the holes here that I couldn't get in through dialogue or acting. That's what a book is for.
I don't know. I guess I just don't see there is... I don't know. I don't like to make the distinction. That's what a book is for. That's what a movie is for. That's what music does, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, obviously these things can borrow from each other, but it's just... There's something so unfilmic about that that it just made the film less of a film, and it already was a terrible film. And so if I'm watching a terrible film that is seeding most of what makes cinema valuable or unique in my mind, it's just nutty.
So I guess you really did not like the cinematography then, as you said.
There were moments where it was kind of beautiful. Thinking about, I almost said Carrie Moss, Elizabeth Moss, standing on the bank of the river with her sister.
Mm-hmm.
That was some beautiful stuff there. The close-up on her face as she went from like extreme sadness to like the fake smiling happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were moments like that really worked.
Didn't you love, I love the shot when he's at his publisher's office and he sees the guy, and without even realizing that he's going, without you even realizing that he's going through something, he just kind of slides out of frame. And then it's this really strange, like, overhead angle shot of him sliding on the chair along the floor toward the guy.
Did you not strike that shot? Me as particularly interesting.
Oh, I thought that was great.
I'm aware of the moment you're talking about, but the art around the moment is lost to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was a really interesting way to kind of break up the rhythm of that scene. But yeah, it was interesting. Also, the way that the combination of Schwartzman's head and facial expression is caught when the Christian Ritter character tells him to go fuck himself and he's playing the piano and he just kind of like jerks his head to the side and keeps playing. It's so perfect.
Yeah, Jason Schwartzman's a great actor, and like whatever good moments there were in this film are all because of the actors somehow fighting against this net they're caught in.
Or what's the line where he's talking about how the relationship is failing, and Jonathan Pryce says to him, "You should make that the subject. It's a potent image. You should make it the subject of your next novel." He said, "Yeah, I thought about it during the silent, excruciating car ride over here." I don't know. It's a thing. This movie just kind of hits my funny bone in a way because it does remind me of things that friends and I would say, just particular ways of phrasing things and particular choices in language. There's definitely a personal component to it.
Right. I mean, like, I recognize personal stuff in things like that exact exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you should make a movie out of my life because I think it would be interminable and boring and you'd I don't know. It's just, there's a reason that even documentaries employ editing.
And this movie has editing.
I'm aware of that, though it really doesn't feel like it most times.
I shouldn't point out that I'm kind of friendly with this movie's editor. Maybe I should, for full disclosure.
I really don't like the editing. It's not like Wolf of Wall Street, where I'm like, whoa, the editing. Or, you know, something by, I don't know, the Requiem for a Dream, where it's like really showy and yeah, maybe it doesn't work for you, but obviously there's an editor. I was just making a joke about this movie being long as hell. You know, I would have slipped your friend a 20 and said, take out 30 in the middle, buddy. No one's going to miss it.
I like the idea of him like $20 is worth like cutting 30 minutes. It's like, he's like, that's not bad. All right.
I was wondering how I was going to buy a pack of New York cigarettes. All right, I'll do it. Danny, you said something earlier that I just wanted to touch on.
Yeah.
You had talked about how within 2 minutes of Inside Llewyn Davis, you liked this guy because he was a good singer.
Yeah.
But then that gets torn down, like, quickly. Like, real quick. And, you know, you never hear any of these guys writing. You only get to hear them spout off at the mouth all the time. And you don't see them writing because, I mean, as a person who writes, I mean, we all write. But, I mean, it's just the most uncinematic thing that you can film a person doing. It's just an awful, like, physical action. And I don't know how you would give any kind of quality to it that would make it worth watching. But, I mean, like, there's something to be said about allowing yourself to have that reaction, a favorable reaction, and then have it get ripped to shreds.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it just immediately starts off on a sour note. And, like, maybe you could make a really high-minded comment, like, well, that's the thing. Like, if you remove the art that makes people like this guy, he's really a miserable person. So, like, what we wanted to do was just carefully edit out around all of his possibly redeeming characteristics to show the empty shell of a human that remains afterwards. But that just doesn't feel as interesting, and it feels like a trick, and it just, it's not... You know, like I said, I got it after the first scene. There wasn't anything else for me to learn during the course of this movie other than to just watch this guy be shit to people, and not even, like, a fun or meaningful Don Draper way, or even, like, a fun and meaningful Peggy Olson way to, you know, bring Elizabeth Moss into it. It was just bad. So I think I'm done talking about this movie. If you two want to continue talking without my dour presence for a while, you can... I mean, I don't even know how to lead this discussion anymore.
It's been such a shocking episode.
Is it? People kept telling me, oh, yeah, this movie's a lot better. I think you're going to like this one. Which, honest to God, I think was just at least one of them lying to me to get me to watch it for this goddamn podcast. Yeah. But, I mean, I just like... And the Dissolve ran a really good review on it. And I trust the Dissolve. You know, there's a lot of good people over there. And, you know, Nick, every once in a while we disagree. But I still usually get where you're coming from. But I just don't fucking see it, man.
Huh.
I don't. And Danny, I don't give a shit about your opinion. So, I don't know.
Fury. So Fury.
So Fury next week. Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, do we want to make a final positive comment?
Yeah.
You guys probably have some other stuff to talk about. I mean, what do you think about the way that both of them, Philip and his girlfriend Ashley, retreat to past relationships as a means of dissecting and understanding their own feelings in the current moment?
Oh, well, one thing I would say that, I think the movie, picks a really good place to begin in terms of like where it starts following Philip with the publication of the second book, because you mentioned them reverting to like exes and stuff. And one of the sort of like hidden undercurrents of this movie is that other than Ike, Philip doesn't really make any new friends. So, like, a lot of his interactions are with exes or with ex-friends and him just, like, tearing them down. So you have, like, the woman in the first scene. Then you have, like, Caitlin Scheel, who he runs into pretty briefly in a pretty weird scene when she, like, runs away from him.
Yeah, that was strange.
Yeah, that was a very weird scene. And so, like, by the end of the movie, you're sort of, like, envisioning where he's going, and it's, like, he's just living a lifestyle where he, right when the movie ends, he's sort of, like, out of gas, even though he's going to go on to become, like, a really good author. I think it just, I thought that was smartly done. Yeah.
I will say I like the fact that he had already written and was about to be published his second novel.
Yeah.
Because usually the movies are like, oh, you got one out, now you got to get the other one. And it's like, you know, everyone has one novel in them, not many have two. I like that. That seemed like a novel place to start, as Danny said.
Final word from me. Fuck you. No.
No, man, let's do this. Let's just do this.
Maybe it's complemented by the fact that as soon as I finished watching this for a second time, I stepped outside and was greeted by a street that was surrounded by leaves with the trees with the fall leaves, you know, the multicolored assemblage that you have and whatnot on a college campus, which is kind of true to much of the film setting. It was kind of like walking into the movie in a way. But after watching it a second time, as I was walking outside, I was thinking to myself, this is most really good movies. Most movies I like a lot, at least, make me want to watch more films, see more films from the director, see more films like it, et cetera, et cetera. This is one of the few movies I know that I really like that instead makes me want to pick up a book and read it and kind of experience everything that literature can provide you that movies cannot necessarily do.
Or given the spirit of the narration, you could just listen to an audiobook.
Okay.
Sorry. No, I did see that tweet of yours, and that gave me a lot of hope for the movie.
Right.
I was not looking forward to this, but I was hoping to be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, as I always do, even though people really like us when we hate things, so this is a good day for my fans, apparently. I never want to hate a movie. I liked, like I said, his catty, bitchy, like, 9 years of pent-up frustration takedown of his ex. Especially because, like, I'm pretty sure that I have a relationship like that with one of mine. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just, I don't know.
Okay. Well, anyway. That's the reaction I had to it, and it was a surprising one. It didn't really hit me the first time, but the second time, maybe it was the book covers or the end credits, I'm not sure. But yeah, it made me want to sit down and crack open a good novel. And I don't know.
Women and Madness.
Women and Madness, or Madness and Women, or Audit.
Audit.
Or Join the Marching Band or something.
The woman's point of view. Join the Street Parade.
Join the Street Parade. I love how the end credits kind of do lean toward where some of these characters will go, such as Zimmerman's daughter writing something like a daughter's point of view. I think that's a fascinating way of kind of following things up briefly.
Was that Zimmerman's daughter that did that?
Yeah.
I thought it was
No. Maybe. She has something else like something, something, something subtitle.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So-and-so.
She has like the dissertation type looking book.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I got you now. Yeah. No, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that as well. We also got to see Josh's book. Josh, the guy who killed himself.
Yeah.
What was his book called?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I don't remember. So that's that for that. Thank you for sticking with us. It's time
to... each other?
What?
Yeah, fucking live together.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy was weird.
Yeah, that guy was weird.
You know what I like to believe? And this is something that helped me like that scene better. You know how the guy keeps punching him in the stomach and it's always like really light, and then he like winds up and the implication is that he hit him really hard and that he got fired because of it? Yes, we're all on board with that?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Jesus. So anyway, so the implication is that he hit him really hard and got fired for it. And then it cuts to him saying, like, oh, this guy, like, he sold me out. He never really meant to do it. What I like to imagine is that Jason Schwartzman was so incapable of actually hitting that guy hard. Like, maybe there was a longer comic take of that scene.
Yeah.
Where he hits him and the guy topples over, like, a couch or something. And it's really awkward for a second. And then he's all like, this is just part of the process. And then the guy, like, storms out. I like to believe that Jason Schwartzman was so incapable of hitting hard at all that they just were like, what if we just cut early? Like, maybe we can just do that.
Ah.
Indeed. It's coming to Blu-ray and DVD. And this is also a perfect time to talk about our contest. So, Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer is coming to Blu-ray. And you have an opportunity to win one of three copies that we're giving away here at the Film Stage. All you have to do is follow the Film Stage Show on Twitter, at Film Stage Show. Look for our tweet about the contest, and then respond back with your favorite film by Bong Joon-ho. So that's coming out tomorrow. Criterion is also releasing two pretty great films for Blu-ray. La Dolce Vita and F for Fake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also coming out in new release, The Purge Anarchy, which I heard was better than the first Purge, which means nothing to me because I didn't see either of them.
You also heard Listen Up, Philip was better than The Color Wheel. Didn't you know?
We never really settled that, did we? Was this better than The Color Wheel?
I think it is a better film, but I don't necessarily like them for the exact same reasons.
Okay.
So.
I think in my own mind, this is a better... I think I agree with what Danny said that guy said about his own stuff.
Yeah.
Like, The Color Wheel did feel like it was at a 4. Like, that felt really lazy to me. And this one at least felt like, hey, I'm going to try a thing. So there's that. There's the progression. Talking about movies that suck, Sex Tape is also coming to Blu-ray. Earth to Echo, which I heard was like an Amblin-style movie for kids, so that could be good, I guess. Wrong Turn 6.
Life After Beth.
Life After Beth. The Fluffy Movie. I don't know, that seems like it's about it to me. I'm going to say that you should probably go out and get the newest season of Mad Men, which has just been released on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
F for Fake is a great movie. Really liked it. And Snowpiercer, of course, I loved as well.
I would say, in terms of new releases, I guess it's just sort of Snowpiercer and really nothing else. I mean, Mad Men, yes, but that's not a movie. The La Dolce Vita disc is exciting. It's good to have it on Blu-ray. And F for Fake. That's the best of the lot, I think. F for Fake is incredible. Really love it. It also seems like Warner Brothers, or not Warner Brothers, but a few classic noir films or crime films are being released.
I was about to say, there's The Girl Hunters.
With Mickey Spillane.
Yeah.
Possessed, Joan Crawford and Van Heflin.
Yeah, I've seen that film, actually.
Oh, what do you think?
She's really great. It's sort of a... it's from the 40s. It's like it's pretty heavy on, like, psychological discourse. There's a lot of scenes where doctors just sort of analyze her behavior, and it's a little bit stagey.
Mm-hmm.
But it has some good stuff. It begins with this shot of her on the street. It sort of begins when she's like reached her breaking point and then moves backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so it begins with her on the street and she's like distraught. And I guess this was a huge thing at the time because it was Joan Crawford being like a mildly less attractive version of Joan Crawford on the street. And everyone's like, oh my God, she's insane.
Yeah, there's also some horror movies coming out, like re-releases, things like Child's Play. This cover for Misery, where it's like a foot sticking out of a typewriter and a sledgehammer hitting it, is a little much. Considering how little actual violence there is in that movie.
Yeah, what a weird cover.
The last house on the left, Species, which I guess counts.
Species, Jesus.
Yeah, and Tasa Hemstridge. Anyway, let's talk about what's coming out to theaters, because that'll be over quickly. Weekend before Halloween, so we gotta have a scary movie based on a children's toy. It's Ouija. Ouija, whatever.
Wait, what?
Ouija?
There's a Ouija movie?
Oh, man, you didn't know about this? Oh, man, you live a blessed life. I'll tell you that much. I've been seeing posters and trailers and those things that are on TV that no one watches anymore. Commercials for this for the longest time. Here, let me read it. Let me read the description to you. A group of friends must confront their most terrifying fears when they awaken the dark powers of an ancient spirit board.
honestly, I did not. Let me look this up.
I'm not lying to you.
No, I'm not saying you're lying. I just is this it?
I think that since we watched Listen Up, Philip, we should watch Ouija.
Oh, like you want to see Ouija?
No, I don't.
produced by the Platinum Dunes guys. That makes
sense. Yeah, man.
Okay. So this is probably really low budget.
This is the spiritual sequel to Battleship.
Especially since I'm looking up these actors, I don't know who any of these people are.
They're young and pretty enough that you would be interested in seeing them, and then really wouldn't feel that bad when they die in a PG-13 manner.
Oh, is it PG-13?
Probably.
I
assume it's PG-13. It's about a Ouija board.
You can make a really dark, disturbing film involving a Ouija board.
Yeah, if you really wanted to. Would be a perfect film for like a really great up-and-coming horror filmmaker to make.
Like really plumb the psychological depths that go into something like
that. Yeah, like is this person like actually dead, or is my friend trying to like beat me out like the thing that I did by pushing the thing? Oh yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff there. I guarantee you this movie doesn't involve any of it.
Probably not.
For instance, one of the biggest moments where the people on screen scream during the trailer is when someone's eyes roll back in their head.
Mm-hmm.
Which is never a good thing. I will, however, say that I am looking forward to seeing John Wick.
Yeah, John Wick looks fun.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
it's also, I know that Keanu Reeves is in it. I know literally nothing about it.
Oh my god, Nick. Well, okay, this one is a little more low-key, but when I saw on Twitter someone say what this movie was about, in fact, even the IMDb thing doesn't really get to the heart of it.
Is it just like a revenge? Or
it's what? An ex-hitman comes out of retirement to track down the gangsters that took everything from him.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So that's what it says that it's about. Here's what it's about. And you'll get this from the trailer. So it's not a spoiler.
I don't care. Can we just move on?
No, the gangsters kill his dog. Dog that his cancer-stricken wife gave him.
Right.
Fantastic. White Bird and the Blizzard, also coming out. Laggies, Citizen 4. Why is so much stuff coming out? Force Majeure, which I'm really looking forward to. Nick, Citizen, you heard about that?
Yeah, I want
to
see that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Citizen 4, I'm curious about, too.
Yeah, I want to see that, too.
I have a real problem with, like, you know, like a news documentary type of thing this soon after a thing would be fine, but like a documentary.
The advanced word on it is really quite strong, though.
Okay, well, I'll be interested in seeing that.
You know, I personally, like, Edward Snowden seems like kind of a douchebag. Like, if you watch like interviews with him,
he's like Philip.
Imagine, like,
he's the Philip of the hacktivist world.
Yes. And so I was very skeptical when it was this documentary about him. I thought it'd be sort of this hagiographic depiction of someone who I think, who I think, you know, kind of clearly has some issues that he needs to work through. But I've heard things about it that are very interesting, that make it sound like it's a more overarching portrayal of the whole NSA business. So that's curious.
That is curious. I'm down with that.
Yeah.
And then 23 Blast and Revenge of the Green Dragons. I don't know.
Revenge of the Green Dragons, executive produced by Martin Scorsese.
Oh, that just means that he brought it to America.
No, he's been backing it since the beginning.
Oh, really?
It's
not
by,
like a Quentin Tarantino joint.
No, it was actually shot in the Bronx, and it's directed by Andrew Lau, who's best known for directing Infernal Affairs.
I was about to say.
Oh, okay.
That, so it's a little connection.
I'd be down for that.
That looks like fun.
It'd be fun. What was that? Oh, Snobakosh. I really wanted to see that.
Right. A movie that had come out years prior and that he just kind of put his name on for some reason.
Well, that's how you get it to America, man.
He's been doing that more and more recently.
I feel like...
And I'm not sure why that is exactly.
I don't know. He realized that Quentin Tarantino could get anything he wanted released in America if he put his name on it. I mean, do you remember how many people thought Hero was directed by Quentin Tarantino?
Right. But does he actually give a shit about Snobakosh? Or is that like a... Is that sort of a thing where he looks at and he realizes he can get money to make things? Maybe
Easy Money?
That. Perhaps. Did he produce Easy Money with Rodney Dangerfield?
Oh, God. Probably. He was doing a lot of coke back then. Okay, so films that we watched on our own. Again, as always, try to keep it brief. And Nick Newman, why don't you kick us off? 1 second,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
So because I'm a terrible person who makes people watch Listen Up, Philip, it's appropriate that I have not been really watching any horror films during the Halloween season. It's all over Twitter. You know, people saying, watch this, watch this, watch this, because it's the season. I'm not really into that. I love horror films, don't get me wrong, but I'm not really into the whole, it's Halloween, so you gotta watch it.
I note that you still haven't changed your Twitter name to a, you know, Halloween pun.
Yeah. Nevertheless, I did end up watching this film called The Most Dangerous Game, a 1932 picture.
Oh, nice.
Based on the famous short story.
Yeah, man.
directed by Irving Cottrell and Ernest B. Schoedsack. I don't know. Danny just went, but anyway.
I remember when I played that game.
I will admit that like most of the reason I even selected this is because it was 12 at night. I kind of didn't have anything specific to do, but I didn't feel like watching something that I was going to have to carry me to the next day. I saw this was 63 minutes long. I thought, okay, 1932 thriller, that seems right up my alley. And lo and behold, it was. It's fascinating because this movie's only an hour long, and it seems to understand that if you're going to make a movie that's an hour long, there's not a lot of room for subtlety, and there's not a lot of room for gray zones. So the movie is this very sort of binary experience. It's between someone who does not want to kill and someone who does want to kill. And it has this incredible shipwreck sequence within the first like 5 minutes that goes from this like very strange... accusatory language that these characters are speaking to each other aboard the ship to suddenly, you know, the camera's just fucking pushing in on like these meters and like the captain's deck of things that are going wrong, and it's people screaming and the ship is blowing up, and then before you know it, he's on an island with a castle with a guy who hunts people. Mm-hmm. And this is like 15 minutes into the movie and you only have 45 minutes to go, and it still manages to fit quite a bit in terms of sort of these strange relationships and these moral questions and character dynamics that really don't feel compromised because of its runtime. Again, it's a movie that understands that there isn't room for subtlety or gray zones, but that doesn't mean you can't develop interesting components. And I thought it worked beautifully. The final shot in particular is really spectacular. It kind of summed up the entire movie for me in a way that I was not expecting, in a way that I really appreciated. So The Most Dangerous Game.
I really want to watch that now because I want to know what that final shot is, because that's one of my favorite final sentences in like literature.
Okay.
Have you read it?
No, I haven't. The thing is, yeah, I mean, it's not like...
it's a huge spoiler, obviously.
Basically, it's one of those final shots where I thought it would be so cool if this was the last shot. And then it
and
was.
And it was? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, man. There so, is no better feeling.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
it's like
it's...
sex.
Yeah. It's not difficult to find because it is on Criterion, and I watched it on Hulu Plus.
Oh, fuck, I know what I'm doing after we hang up. Nope, I'm editing this. Never mind.
All right, well... you can watch it tomorrow night and it won't take up too much of your time.
I could watch it twice in the time it took to watch Listen Up, Philip. That's how I'm going to measure the rest of my life.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's great. I'm glad to know.
Yeah, that was a good start.
I'll watch it. If I like it, then your crimes against me are forgiven.
All right.
I appreciate that. Danny King, what is something that you watch?
Well, I have a very appropriate recommendation for the film we discussed.
Is it a pile of dog shit?
Because...
the rain?
Oh my god. well, yeah, so... wait, what? so, in anticipation for the release of Listen Up, Philip, BAM Cinematheque in Brooklyn let Perry program a few films that he thought were influences. And then he gave an intro at them. So I went to one night, which had two films. And the first one was Husbands and Wives, which I think I've mentioned before. It's like one of Woody Allen's kind of darkest films. And it actually, for me at least, lost a little bit of its power watching it with a crowd, because the movie, being a Woody Allen film, obviously has clever lines. But there were moments where, like, there's especially one really extended take with Sidney Pollack that is just so disturbing. But, like, the crowd was laughing for, like, the first half of the take before kind of realizing, like, how dark it was. So sort of things like that that were just, like, kind of annoying. But the second film, which is the one I was really looking forward to because I knew absolutely nothing about it, was called Rich Kids, from 1979, directed by a guy named Robert M. Young. I didn't know anything about it. And it turned out to be a nice film about kids dealing with their parents' divorce in New York. So it seems like a sort of influence on kind of the environmental nature of Listen Up, Philip. Like Nick mentioned, it's sort of a timeless New York that Perry kind of creates. And so, like, if you put Listen Up, Philip next to Rich Kids, like, the two New Yorks would look very similar. So you probably can't find this film anywhere. But it was nice. And it's always just really fun to kind of go into a movie knowing absolutely nothing about it. So, like, the movie begins with this really bizarre scene where John Lithgow returns home at, like, 6 a.m. And his daughter's, like, at the window marking down when he's coming home. And then he, like, gets into his bedroom and the wife's asleep, like, passed out drunk. And he sort of changes into his pajamas. And it's just all this, like, activity that you have no idea how to explain it yet this early in the film. So it was kind of a perfect beginning. It's like, all right, I'm excited to see this film because I don't know anything about it. And then the first 10 minutes were, like, inexplicable. So it was, like, it was really kind of, it was a lot of fun. But eventually it makes sense. It's not like an experimental film where the behavior doesn't make sense or anything.
All right. One moment. So, I did not get a chance to watch a lot, which sucks, mainly because of a lack of time. However, I was around for the moment when one of my roommates put on The Rescuers, the 1977 Walt Disney film that features two mice trying to save a little girl who has been kidnapped and is forced to look for a diamond in the bottom of a cave in a bayou. This is actually one of those movies. It happened in that really weird period where, like, Disney was out of their first golden age and was still really struggling to, like, find a voice for the modern times. And one of the reasons that I like it is because one of my favorite kind of under-heralded animation guys, like a guy who really seemed like he could have gone somewhere until he just everything kind of went wrong, I guess, is Don Bluth. Anyone familiar with Don Bluth?
Arrested Development?
No.
I do know the name.
So he was a... what was his...
Animator?
Yeah, obviously he was an animator. He was a directing animator on The Rescuers, and he was one of the, like, people who defected from Disney, because Disney was trying to get real cheap on some shit, and so he wanted to make, like, real, honest-to-goodness, old-fashioned animations, and so he, like, left and helped make things like The Secret of Nim, An American Tale, The Land Before Time, All Dogs Go to Heaven, and then it starts going downhill with things like Rockadoodle, Thumbelina, A Troll in Central Park, brief, vague resurgence with Anastasia, and then Titan A.E. And his last credit as director is Gift of the Hoopoe? It doesn't even matter. So, I like this movie. It's really got that hand-drawn thing. Like, you can see, like, the roughness and the pencil lines. And it's just a beautiful film to look at, despite the fact that it lacks the polish of things like, oh, The Little Mermaid or The Lion King. You know, things that would come out and really revitalize the Disney brand after they kind of went to shit and then finally, like, had a near-death knell with The Black Cauldron. So The Rescuers, it's on Netflix. It's not that long, and it's not as dopey as this, like, re-release cover makes it look. Which is something that I've always hated about the way Don Bluth films are, like, this is really obscure. The way they're marketed, they always give them, like, the Disneyfication with, like, the smooth lines and, like, everyone's smiling and happy. He makes some dark fucking movies, guys. So, like, watch The Secret in Him. There's a scene
with
people getting, like, stabbed and slashed that basically functions as, like, the climax of The Departed, but with mice with daggers. It's a really good film, though. And you know what? I could talk about him for a while, but I won't. Take my... What's that word I'm looking for? It's the opposite of what I had for Listen Up, Philip. Enthusiasm. Positive enthusiasm. Hey-oo. Take my enthusiasm, my positive enthusiasm as a, you know, just see it, you know, it's a good film. It's over. That's it. We've come to the end. Not sure what we'll be talking about next week. As we said, it's a pretty weak, God, I'm so sad that I did that for movies. We may be talking about either Whiplash or Birdman. Birdman is the one that's kind of causing the biggest hailstorm online right now. And it's got Michael Keaton in it. So, I mean, like, that's always a good thing. But we'll figure it out, and we'll be back next weekend to talk about some movies with you. As always, follow us on Twitter, at Film Stage Show. Don't forget to look out for our tweet about the Snowpiercer giveaway. Email us at podcast@filmstage.com. Comment and rate on iTunes. And follow me and my illustrious co-hosts around the internet. Let us tell you where. Danny King.
Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
Mm-hmm.
TheFilmStage.com,
mm-hmm.
ListenUp.org.
Fuck off. Zeke Newman, what about yourself?
You can find me at TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and PhilipLewisFriedmanFanfiction.gov.
Honest question.
Yes.
When you thought about that joke, were you talking about fan fiction based on the novels of Philip Lewis Friedman, or were you thinking about fan fiction regarding Philip Lewis Friedman?
It's actually both.
Oh, okay.
And the thing is, in the Roth spirit, it can kind of be both at once. It can be synonymous, you know?
Right.
They can sort of be autobiographical. Right. So, but both. Both.
So it's like his Bilderman and a Mary Sue story, like, rolled into one.
Sure.
Cool. You can find me on the internet, dearfilm.net. Again, still haven't really posted anything there because it's been pretty shitty for the last couple months. I'll try to get something up. Filmstage.com, been doing a lot more there. And Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. I will not make a joke because I'm too angry to think of one. That is it. Join us next week when we'll talk about something obscure. And have yourself a good time until then. Until they fuck each other and their brother and sister. Yeah, that movie. I didn't like that movie.
Spoiler.
Who gives a fuck?